Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador. The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro. ¿Dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.
Pushkin. This show contains adult language and occasional descriptions of violence. Please keep that in mind when choosing when and where to listen. It's May 1973, Iowa City. There's a damp chill in the air. We are on a sort of shabby block in front of a brick apartment building with a white door in need of a paint job and a storefront window with its blinds drawn shut. The sidewalk just in front of the door is covered in blood. And it looks like the blood might be seeping out from under the door jamb. It's a busy weekday, and as pedestrians pass the puddle of blood, they notice it and casually step around it. Eventually, a man in a green and black plaid jacket pauses and looks around, as if looking for an explanation. When none comes, he walks away. Then a well-dressed white woman uses her umbrella to poke at the bloody puddle. But after a moment or two of inspection, she also walks away. Finally, an older gentleman emerges from a nearby storefront and silently cleans up the mess. And the evidence of whatever happened is suddenly gone. And with it disappears any account of whose blood was spilled and how. The whole scene is being captured by two young women in their 20s, sisters, who sit in an old car parked nearby. One of them holds a Super 8 camera, the kind you'd make home movies with back then. The other snaps photos with a 35mm camera. They are Ana and Raquel Mendieta, Cuban refugees who landed in this unlikely place as children. In 1973, Ana was a first-year MFA student at the University of Iowa. She was funny, loud, outrageous, and had a take-no-prisoners vibe. And, in the way of sisters, she had roped Raquel into helping her make a new piece. And like many works Ana made, it would come to seem tragically prophetic in the wake of her death.
She basically staged what looked like the remnants of physical violence with what looked like blood in the doorway of a building. And I thought it was extremely powerful for a very young artist to be doing that and to be doing it in this small, largely white town of Iowa City was fascinating to me.
That's Connie Butler, one of the many curators who would come to admire and study Anna Mendieta's work in the decades that followed. The photos and film the Mendieta sisters took that day would ultimately become a work of art called Moffett Building Piece.
The fact that it still exists only in these little 35 millimeter slides, which, you know, you have to get very close to with a loop, and it's a very intimate way of viewing these things, you know, that implicates you as a viewer too, almost as if you are yourself looking at a crime scene.
Anna's interest in blood wasn't only meant to shock. She was keenly aware of violence and injustice. When she made the Moffett Building piece, she was investigating her own community's reaction to a brutal crime, a rape and murder that had happened on campus a few months before. Here's how she explained her inspiration.
A young woman was killed, raped and killed at Iowa in one of the dorms, and it just really freaked me out. So I did several rape performances type things at that time using my own body. I did something I believe in and that I felt I had to do.
That's not actually Anna Mendieta's voice you're hearing. That was Tanya Bruguera, another artist from Cuba, who you'll hear from more later. Anna Mendieta's question was, could you make art about something so awful? And she used blood, not paint. Blood is the most essential substance of life. Could it jolt people out of their daily routines? Could blood make people pay attention? She didn't know it yet, but the Moffett Building piece was about to be her first major artwork. And in a circular way, that's kind of terrifying. The question she asked about how we react when we encounter the residue of violence, this question would haunt all of us after she died. I'm your host, Helen Molesworth, and from Pushkin Industries, Something Else, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Death of an Artist, Episode 1, The Haunting. For my entire professional life, I've been a member of something called the art world, an exclusive network of artists, gallery dealers, curators, collectors, and philanthropists. For 2 decades, I was lucky enough to be a museum curator, making me one of a small group of cultural insiders who determine what art we see and how we talk about it. In the museum world and in art history, there are a lot of unspoken rules about what you can say publicly and what is supposed to stay private. It turns out I wasn't that good at sticking to the script. And I guess I'm still not good at it, because I'm going to tell you Anna Mendieta's whole story, all the way to its shocking and troubling end. And much to my surprise, I discovered it's a story many of my colleagues in the art world would prefer I didn't tell. At first blush, it seemed like people didn't want me to talk about it because of who else is part of that story. Anna's husband, the famous sculptor Carl Andre. He is one of the so-called fathers of minimalism, a cultural hero to many, a revered artist with lots of connections. And he was a suspect in Anna's death. Even though Carl Andre and Anna Mendieta were a highly visible art world couple, even though something terrible happened between them the night she died, you will not read about it on a museum wall label or in most art history textbooks. Reviews of their exhibitions tend to take care of it in a sentence or two. You would not know that Mendieta's death divided the art world in 1985, and in many ways, still does. I'm not the first person to try and tell this story. In fact, many of the voices you'll hear in this show are from interviews conducted by investigative journalist Robert Katz. He published a book in 1990 that remains the most comprehensive look into this art world tragedy. He spoke with dozens of Anna and Carl's friends in noisy restaurants, in parks, in busy offices. And you'll hear the voices of some art world insiders on these tapes who have since decided not to talk. Most folks don't want to discuss what happened that night. They don't want to talk about what the ramifications of that night were on the art world. They don't want to contemplate what it means when a community is torn apart by violence. And they don't want to discuss whether or not justice has been served. All these different folks not talking for all of their different reasons means that a veil of silence started to fall over this project. And I can't lie, the more silence we encountered, the more sad and frustrated I became. And the more silence we encountered, the more I wanted to talk.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member, FDIC, copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador. The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro. ¿Dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.
Both Ana Mendieta and Carl Andre were incredible artists. This could have been a story about a romance between two fascinating people, but their story ends in a 911 call. Those who loved Ana Mendieta loved her fiercely.
Ana was extremely good company. Super interesting, super funny, super lively. She was always making plans, making schemes, getting you involved in something.
She decided that the only way to get by in Rome was to learn how to curse when you drove. And she would, like, keep her window, she told me, the left window down all the time so she could put her arm out and flare the finger and curse at people when they could hear her.
Ana was a contradictory, you know. She was a vegetarian, but she loved to order steak tartare. She was funny. She was engaging. She was very vital. She was the kind of person you don't forget.
Like a lot of people who are unforgettable, even though everybody remembered her, not everyone liked her. Her penchant for pushing boundaries and not giving a fuck what anyone else thought both compelled and sometimes irritated people.
She was very magnetic.
That's B. Ruby Rich, a prominent film scholar and a good friend of Anna's.
But she was also, as you may have heard, very, very argumentative. And so often people would end up in a fight with her. But I found her very entertaining even then.
Anna's art school classmates remembered her early days of art making as very experimental. Sometimes a little gross, sometimes kind of fun. Anna would sneak into the copy center and Xerox her breasts and her labia. She'd get buckets of blood from the butcher and carry them into the woods, where she'd strip down, hide parts of her body under leaves. And then she'd have her friends splatter blood around her and take photos. She got one of her friends to trim his beard, and then she glued the hair to her own face. In the 1970s, art was starting to get radical, and Anna was at the forefront. The world was changing. The women's movement, the anti-war movement were in full effect. And those movements inspired artists to engage more directly with current events and the public. Many artists wanted their art to be outside the confines of a museum or a gallery. So they staged performances in public spaces and started using non-art materials borrowed from everyday life. Back then, Manhattan was the undisputed center of the art world. It was where the action was. Like most young, ambitious artists of the time, after finishing her degree in Iowa, Anna made her way to New York. There, she found a vibrant downtown scene dominated by radical artists challenging the status quo of art. One of the most important players at the time was the already famous sculptor, Carl Andre.
This question is that art? That's always the American Philistine question. How can you call that art? And it's easy to call things art, very easy. But the question is it good or bad or useless? And that question is not generally asked.
Notorious for his genre-busting work, Andre looked exactly how an artist was supposed to look. He was a stocky white man who sported a bohemian beard and wore a uniform of workers' overalls. He was a fixture in the boozy Soho art scene. He had a reputation for his intellect, his drinking, and his sharply worded opinions. And he helped to invent a movement, so much so that he is typically referred to as a founding father of minimalism.
Andre played a central role in defining the visual vocabulary of minimalism and essentially redefined the very nature of sculpture itself.
Minimalism completely dominated the art scene of the late 1960s and 70s. Loosely speaking, it's a type of sculpture known for its rigorous abstraction and simplicity. Think cubes, rectangles, basic geometric forms, all of which were made using industrial materials like steel, plywood, and fluorescent tubes. The vibe was cool, intellectual, and severe. These minimalist guys, and they were predominantly guys, didn't think art was about emotions or pretty pictures. For them, art was a philosophical arena, a place to challenge outmoded ideas and develop new ones. Today, we might call this disruption. Back then, it was called the avant-garde. Andre's major contribution was to remove sculpture from its pedestal and to examine its relation to the floor. There would be no more monuments, no heroic reaching for the sky, no guys on horseback. Instead, Andre would make sculpture as close to the floor as he could get, so close that you could even walk on them. Similar to Mendieta's use of blood, Andre was playing with a huge taboo in the art world. He broke the fundamental rule of don't touch, and in doing so, paved the way for a new kind of art. And like Mendieta, he inspired strong reactions. Not everyone was a fan of either him or his work.
I'm not sure where the art is in it.
They just look like tiles.
I found him insufferable. He always dressed up in his little worker's costume to show a badge of being a working class artist, his overalls, which was faintly ridiculous by then, as he lived in this luxury building with a doorman.
I had little dealings with Andre except to be insulted by him periodically.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, now Carl's not the nicest personality in the world.
He's always extremely competitive with Saul. Extremely.
That last voice is Carol LeWitt, wife of the equally famous conceptual artist Saul LeWitt, who Carl was friends with for decades. If you can't quite hear what she was saying, she noted how competitive Carl could be with Saul. Controversy came early to Carl Andre. He used everyday building materials such as bricks and metal plates, which he typically just placed on the floor. Because Andre's work was not carved, bolted, or welded, and was always just simply arranged or placed, it inspired as much derision in the popular press as it did admiration in the art world. When London's most important contemporary art museum bought a piece, all hell broke loose.
In the 1970s, the Tate acquired a piece by Carl Andre called Equivalent 8, a low-lying piece on the ground of fire bricks that are arranged in a grid.
That's art historian Julia Bryan Wilson, a professor who teaches her UC Berkeley students about both Carl Andre and Anna Mendieta.
It became a kind of press scandal how much the sculpture was purchased for and how, you know, it was one of these, like, my kid could do it kind of arguments.
When an interviewer asked Carl Andre about it later, he seemed amused by the controversy.
Bad publicity is as good as good publicity. It's not whether it's nice. I mean, if they say it's nice and that's all, that's no good. If they go on for hours and hours saying how terrible it is, that's good.
It's one thing to have bravado about the bad press for your artwork, but this wouldn't be Andre's worst brush with the tabloids. But we'll get to that later. For the moment, we're still squarely in the 1970s, a high-flying time for avant-garde artists who made up a tight-knit community that revolved around a handful of bars, restaurants, and galleries. Most artists were still relatively poor, taking day jobs to make ends meet, making art in the after hours. And when she first arrived in New York, Anna was one of those artists. But a handful of artists became wildly successful from the sale of their work, and Carl was one of those artists. It was in this heady mixture of ideas and art and booze that Carl and Anna would meet in a packed gallery in November 1979. But this is no rom-com. It's a tragedy. And it involves two impressive, complex, flawed humans, two artistic powerhouses who changed how we think about art. Anna and Carl's fateful meeting would entangle their lives and reputations forever. They would become symbolic of so much more that was larger than just them as people. They came to represent insider versus outsider, male versus female, white versus Latinx, cool and intellectual versus bodily and emotional. In a way, it's almost too overdetermined. But none of this symbolism changes the fact that Anna was trying to elbow her way to a seat at the table that had already been set for Carl. When Anna arrived in New York, she quickly fell in with a small coterie of other women artists trying to make their way in an incredibly white and male-dominated art world. She joined a feminist gallery called AIR, and after about a year and a half in Manhattan, Anna was ready for her first solo exhibition. She came out of the gate strong with a compelling body of work she called silhueta, the Spanish word for silhouette. The show was made up of a suite of photographs hung plainly on the wall, no fancy frames, nothing to distract from the image. The silhueta series had occupied Anna for years. Some of the photographs show her lying naked on the earth, covered with leaves, flowers, or grass. Others depict the outline of a human body pressed into the ground. Still others show a mild indentation, a shallow space where a body once lay. The press release for the show described her project as, quote, an ongoing dialogue between the artist and nature. The works were part performance art, part earth art. In order to drum up attendance, Anna's friend and colleague, the artist Nancy Spiro, organized a panel discussion and invited the famous Carl Andre to speak. The title of the panel discussion was, I kid you not, How Has the Women's Art Movement Affected Male Art Attitudes? Such was the state of feminism in the New York art world circa 1979. But the idea worked, and the panel drew the crowd they were seeking. And then, during the talk, something strange started to happen to Anna's photographs. Nancy Spiro told the journalist Robert Katz about it.
Her pictures started popping off the wall. What happened was, I think, that maybe the heat of all the people in there must have been some warping or expansion. It was very bizarre. And so during this evening, they popped off the wall.
Yeah, what an embarrassment.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yeah.
She was very upset about this.
This old tape from the 1980s is hard to hear, but Nancy is saying that Anna's photographs fell off the wall in the middle of the event. After the panel discussion wrapped up, the almost always generous Carl took several people out to a Japanese restaurant next door.
And I think Carl then invited Anna. He didn't even know who she was. So this was very gracious.
Mm-hmm.
Nancy and Anna stayed behind to make sure Anna's photos were back on the wall. And when they finally joined the dinner, Carl paid Anna a lot of attention. Perhaps his left-wing politics led him to be interested in an exile from Cuba. Perhaps he could sense an affinity between their art. Both were exploring the horizontal quality of the floor, the ground, and the earth as a space for sculpture. Perhaps it was just your typical heterosexual shenanigans, as Anna was undeniably charismatic and attractive, and Carl had the shine of art world fame and stardom. Anna's friend, Natalia Delgado, thought it was a case of opposites attracting.
He had a Karl Marx type of look, this long hair and then a big full beard, wearing overalls, and he was so tall and kind of heavy, and Anna, she looked very slight compared to him. He looked like a bear.
Here's how Anna's friend Ella Troiano, a Cuban-American filmmaker, described her.
Anna was small, thin, very pretty, very vivacious. She was dark, what somebody would have called exotic looking. And she had that kind of look that wasn't easily classifiable.
And thus began a tangled, on-again, off-again relationship between an older, already legendary, and twice-divorced man and the young, up-and-coming artist, but Natalia felt they made sense together.
There was an intellectual attraction because of the interest in art, and that was a big part of their relationship. I think that she admired him because of his accomplishments as an artist, so I think that was part of the attraction for her. And he also gave her advice, and I think he did expose her to artists that were, you know, they would go to Tuscany and go to have lunch with Sol LeWitt, and they would get together at a party with Frank Stella.
Frank Stella was another hugely successful contemporary of Carl's.
You know, it gave her an exposure to people that were really Carl's friends and really stayed as Carl's friends, but that she probably would not have met initially on her own.
As is so often the case for women, Anna was frequently described as being ambitious in a way that was more accusation than accolade. Even some of her friends, like the conceptual artist Louise Kamnitzer, made the subtle assumption that she got together with Carl for his connections.
I didn't forgive her for entering a marriage situation with somebody that was, according to her, very problematic. And I thought, as partially a career move. But she definitely was ambitious and wanted to make it.
That Carl might have been equally attracted to her rising star energy did not seem to enter the equation for anyone. Whatever the nuance of the attraction, they became an art world couple, taking their place in a social circle filled with the big names of the Soho art scene at the time. They socialized with other couples whose names you might know from the walls of art museums. Saul and Carol LeWitt, Lawrence and Alice Weiner, Nancy Spiro and Leon Golub. By all accounts, they were feisty, and as was the habit of the time, the booze flowed freely at art world openings and dinners, fueling the whole scene. Anna was known for mixing her wine with water, while Carl liked champagne and good wine. And after copious amounts of drinking, things could get uncomfortable.
So on one level, we had good discussions, but then as they proceeded to get drunker or things, there was just a kind of strange, neurotic
interaction between them.
Between them, that you would witness.
Mm-hmm.
They were very loud.
Mm-hmm.
They get into arguments.
Yeah, they
would. Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Carl could be very cutting and snide.
Yeah.
She would be more or less, retaliate in her own way.
Right.
We got to the point where I didn't like to be with them,
uh-huh.
You know, which is something that I didn't feel about either of them individually.
Carl can be really quite nice and wonderful, except when he drinks too much. He becomes Dr. Jekyll. He would be difficult to be around.
Yeah.
Like I said, this isn't a rom-com. Darkness is creeping in. One of Anna's friends could feel it coming.
I didn't know what to do. How can you tell someone's going to kill you?
That story after the break.
Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase, NA member FDIC, 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Co.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador. The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro. ¿Dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.
Anna would always take me out to dinner for my birthday.
That's Howard Dina Pindell, an artist, a co-founder of AIR, and a former curator at the Museum of Modern Art. In 1979, she was in a terrible car accident that left her with a head injury and memory issues. And it also left her with a high degree of emotional sensitivity.
What I found was I was somewhat sensitive. I don't want to say psychic, but I was sensitive from the injury. We were at a restaurant, which no longer exists, just the three of us, no one else was there. They both drank a lot near the end of the meal. And it literally just flashed across my mind, literally, he's going to kill her with his hands. And I was stunned when I heard that or felt that thought or whatever. I didn't know what to do. How can you tell someone's going to kill you? And why trust a voice, you know, or a thought? So
I'm assuming that you didn't tell Anna that...
There's no way I would have told her. I mean, you know, you don't... You know, you discount. I mean, how can I prove it? Yeah, so no. I just felt I couldn't say anything. I kind of pushed it into the back of my mind.
Things have started to get a little woo-woo. First the photos fall off the wall, and then there's Anna's friend Howardina carrying around this awful, terrible vision that Anna's life will end in violence. Perhaps Howardina was picking up on the energy between Anna and Carl. After all, the record shows they had plenty of tension. And one of their perennial problems was how they compared professionally. One of Anna's closest friends, Natalia Delgado, remembers going to an exhibit of one of the most famous art couples of all time, Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo.
I went to the show with Anna, and she showed me this painting. There's a painting by Frida Kahlo of Diego and herself. And Diego's big, and Frida's next to him, and she's quite small by comparison. And he said to Anna, "This is us. This is us. We are Diego and Frida."
The Kahlo painting from 1931 is a classic. In it, Frida paints Diego standing ramrod straight, enormous as a redwood, his feet the scale of ham hocks planted solidly on the ground. His gaze, smug and confident, engages the viewer directly, and in one hand he holds a painter's palette and several brushes. It's a consummate image of the great artist, the grand old master. Frida, on the other hand, is bird-like. Her feet are so tiny that she almost looks like a doll. Her right hand gently touches Diego, while her left hand gathers her shawl around her torso. Even though she is the artist who painted this picture, she offers herself as wife, companion, and accessory to his main event.
What did Anna think of that comparison?
She thought he had a big ego, that he was comparing himself to Diego Rivera. That's what she said. What an ego.
Do you think she felt he was rivalrous or threatened
by
her rise?
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. And I think that the whole description of he was Diego and she was Frida Kahlo, in a way they look very much, you know, he looked like Diego, he was big and hefty, and she was small and petite, was a way of kind of saying, look, I'm more important than you. Diego was still the more prominent artist. And I do think that's how he, Carl, wanted it to be. And I do think that was an issue for them. And she would say it. She'd say, well, look, Carl, you know, my career is on the rise right now. And I think that really, really rubbed him the wrong way. He found that very threatening.
It was a prescient comparison. In the 1980s, Diego was the hero, and Frida was still just a footnote in art history. Diego, like Carl, was known for his Marxist politics and his history of thumbing his nose at capitalism. Carl had been active in the anti-war movement and adopted the posture that the artist was similar to a day laborer. Diego was the muralist who painted the workers rather than the factory owners. Both Frida and Anna in their lifetimes were the lesser-than partners to their male genius companions. What neither Frida nor Anna could have known was how the tides would change and how they would each become the bigger star in their own right. But again, that's more rushing ahead. It's late summer, 1985. Carl and Anna had gotten married in January. They'd been spending most of their time in Europe and were just now back in New York getting ready to set up house together. Anna was going to give up her small apartment in Little Italy and move into Carl's place. She asked her friend Marcia Pels to help her with the move.
She called me, and we were going to move her stuff and then go out and have a drink and dinner.
Right. So you were going to move her books on Sunday to Carl's apartment?
But then she called me up Thursday night.
Yeah.
She was very upset, and she said, I can't talk to you now. The plans have changed, but I'm going to be moving things from Carl's to my apartment.
Anna had changed her plans. Instead of moving more of her stuff into Carl's apartment, she wanted to move everything out of Carl's apartment.
They had some kind of fight before the last fight.
Yeah.
And she decided that she was going to not move in and move the things out.
We've arrived at the threshold of our terrible story. Sunday, September 8th, 1985, a mere 9 months after their wedding. There's a lot we don't know about that evening. Here are a few things we know for certain. We know that Anna never moved her things as she had planned to. We know that the unhappy couple spent the evening at Carl's place, an apartment on the 34th floor of a relatively new luxury high-rise in Greenwich Village. That night, like New Yorkers everywhere, they ordered Chinese food and watched TV. Then, sometime after 5 a.m., a passerby on the street below heard a woman scream, "No, no, no." A moment later, there was a sound like an explosion on the roof of the deli below Carl's apartment. Anna had fallen from above. Carl called 911 at 5:29 a.m. We don't have the tape of that call. After the verdict, the whole trial record, including the call, was sealed. But a reporter who heard it played at trial said Carl Andre's voice was distressed, that he wailed, and that his explanation was interrupted with cries and moans. We've asked voice actors to read parts of the transcript of the 911 call.
Again, my wife has committed suicide.
Carl gives the address, his phone number, and says they're on the 34th floor. The operator asks, what happened exactly?
Yeah, what happened was my wife is an artist and I'm an artist, and we had a quarrel about the fact that I was more exposed to the public than she was. And she went to the bedroom and I went after her, and she went out of the window.
She jumped out of the window. How long ago did this happen?
Well, I don't know. It was, I don't know.
They talk for several more seconds.
Did it happen recently? Did it happen just now?
No, it happened just now. I mean, I can't tell you.
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't help you. Please.
Okay, we'll be there as soon as possible.
Please.
In September of 1985, I was a sophomore in college in Albany, New York. I had already walked on top of one of Carl Andre's sculptures. They were installed in nearly every museum in the country. I'd be lying if I didn't tell you how much I love them. I was completely turned on by their taboo-breaking, fuck-you energy, the severity of his metal plates lying on the floor in a simple checkerboard pattern. Almost struck me as punk in my younger, brasher years. I didn't learn about Anna Mendieta until years after her death, when I was well into graduate school. And even then, I learned about her from a fellow student, not through any of my professors. I was trained by art historians who believe the prime directive was to separate the life of the artist from their work. This meant no one ever said that Carl Andre was married to Anna Mendieta, much less that he was accused of murdering her. Top that off with the fact that Anna Mendieta was a Cuban immigrant, showing at a feminist gallery, working with blood, making work that summoned the idea of the Earth Goddess. Nothing could have been less cool in my philosophically inclined education that privileged theory over feeling. But during the first two decades of the 21st century, the world changed a lot and fast. And I think I did, too.
You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon.
That this moment and where we are right now is a resurgence from where the civil rights movement left off.
President Trump is defending a temporary travel ban for seven Muslim-majority countries.
Is a monument to white supremacy.
Thousands of women are using two words on social media to identify themselves as survivors of sexual harassment and assault today. It's hashtag MeToo.
We still believe in you.
I found myself thinking about Anna, because she did go on to become a Frida Kahlo-like figure, more powerful after her death than before, larger than life, revered. Scores of artists, mostly women, studied her, reenacted her performances, paid homage to her with their own work. They make pilgrimages to the important sites of her life, Havana, Iowa City, Rome, Greenwich Village. And over the years, I came to love Anna Mendieta's art because it felt so urgent, so relevant, because politics did start to feel personal and identity does matter. But could I love Mendieta's work while also still being a fan of Carl Andre's sculptures? Or did I have to choose sides? It felt like the only way to answer that question was by asking another. What really happened the night Anna died? I wondered what we might be able to learn if we return to her story. When we first started making this podcast, I assumed folks would want to talk about what happened between Anna and Carl. Man, was I wrong.
I don't want to, like, badger you. You know what I mean?
Right. Right.
May I ask you what you think the harm would be?
A lot of my calls went like that.
I obviously wish we saw eye to eye on this one. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time. Okay, bye.
Silence was starting to feel like a main character in this story. Perhaps some art world insiders just want to protect their own professional relationships with Carl Andre or with the art dealers he's tight with. But it's not just those who are loyal to Carl who remain quiet. Many of Anna's friends also no longer want to talk. Quite a few folks turned us down, citing reasons ranging from busy schedules to not wanting to revisit the pain to not wanting to discuss Carl and Anna's relationship. We also tried to talk to the estate of Anna Mendieta, even though it's well known that they don't participate in conversations that include Carl Andre. They prefer the focus to be solely on Anna Mendieta's artwork. The more I thought about all the different reasons people have for not wanting to talk, the more I felt that the silence wasn't only protecting Carl Andre. There were so many other ideas at stake. I was in a community at odds with itself, unresolved about gendered power dynamics, unsure of the boundaries between private and public, and ultimately divided on whether it wanted institutional stability or cultural change. As frustrating as it was to get turned away over and over, honestly, it kind of lit a fire in me. The more silence we encountered, the more I felt like there was something important to say about that silence. I keep coming back to Anna Mendieta's work. The Moffett Building piece was just one in a series of pieces she made with blood, where she invited people to look at the blood, to look at the violence. Some people say Anna was morbid, that maybe she had a death wish, but that's not what I see when I look at her work. The Moffett Building piece, really all of her work with blood, it's not about her. It's about you. It's about us. Her work is asking us to stop and pay attention. It's asking us to bear witness, to look, to not walk by, to open the door. And that's what we're going to do. Coming up on Death of an Artist, the story of what happened after Carl's 911 call.
How could Carl, who represented the purity of this art, how could he have done such an act like that?
He had two different stories, and we confronted him on that.
Carl's attorney basically based his analysis of why she might have committed suicide on Santeria, on voodoo.
There was a sense of someone this tough, this strong,
this brilliant as Anna could be killed, then any of us could be killed.
Well, sometimes people would scream at you on the street. It was quite a confrontational thing, yes.
And why it still angers so many artists today.
I just started tweeting, like, there will be blood.
Andre, Andre, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when we come for you? Andre, Andre, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when we come for you?
Death of an Artist is a co-production between Pushkin Industries, Something Else, and Sony Music Entertainment. Written and hosted by me, Helen Molesworth.
Executive producers are Lizzie Jacobs, Tom Koenig, Lital Malad, Jacob Weisberg, and Lucas Werner.
Produced by Maria Luisa Tucker. Editing by Lizzie Jacobs. Our managing producer is Jacob Smith. Associate producers are Pooj Roo and Eloise Linton.
Additional production help by Tali Abacasis.
Voice acting by Nick Berain and David Glover. Anna Mendieta's quotes were read by Tanya Bruguera. Engineered by Sam Baer. Fact-checking by Andrea Lopez Cruzado. Our theme song is by Pooj Roo. If you love this show, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus to listen early, ad-free, and get exclusive bonus content. Look for the Pushkin Plus channel on Apple Podcasts or at pushkin.fm. Find more great podcasts from Sony Music Entertainment at sonymusic.com/podcasts.
Yo tengo casi 33 años de ser forense. Nunca había visto una escena así.
In spring 2021, reporter Brian Avelar launched an investigation that began in the depths of a grave dug by a serial killer and ended with the government forcing him and other journalists to flee El Salvador. Sonoro and Revista Factum present Humo. Murder and Silence in El Salvador. The story behind a country where the truth and its citizens' rights are buried under the weight of power.
Señor Ministro, ¿dónde está Karen y Eduardo Guerrero? ¿Dónde están mis hijos?
Listen to Humo, Murder and Silence in El Salvador, wherever you get your podcasts.